Hey there, it's Frank Buckley. Today on the podcast, it's a conversation with the Academy Award-winning director of the feature documentary Icarus, and now The Dissident. Brian Fogel has done it again with a feature documentary that plays like a thriller. The Dissident refers to Jamal Khashoggi, the Washington Post columnist and prominent Saudi Arabian journalist, a former insider in the Saudi regime who had become a critic, who was brutally murdered by a Saudi assassination squad who killed him at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, Turkey. Brian takes us behind the scenes of the investigation into the very room where Khashoggi was killed. We're there with investigators as they discover gruesome evidence. We meet Khashoggi's fiancée and experience her most intimate moments of grief. Brian also gains access to the world of a Saudi activist on the move in Canada who believes a team may be on the way to kill him too. The documentary, The Dissident, is available on demand, but not as a free offering on Amazon or Netflix, and even that is part of the story. All of it taking place against the backdrop of American policy towards Saudi Arabia and a new administration's consideration of how the U.S. should view the country, and especially its crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, better known as MBS. Here's my conversation about The Dissident with director Brian Fogel. Brian, congratulations on a terrific film. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, and a pleasure to be speaking to you, Frank.
Same here. This documentary exposes some ugly truths about Saudi Arabia and its crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, as people may know him. It takes us right inside the consulate where Mr. Khashoggi was brutally murdered. We're actually going to see footage of the Turkish investigators as they discover some of that grisly evidence. We'll take a look at a clip of that from the film in just a moment. But first, for folks who may not remember, Brian, who was Jamal Khashoggi and why was he murdered?
So Jamal Khashoggi was 60 years old at the time of his murder. He had spent most of his life as a Saudi journalist, traveling back and forth between Saudi Arabia and Washington or London, essentially helping to advocate for Saudi policies and then writing about this for the Saudi press. So technically, he was working for the Saudi royal family. But Jamal was educated in America at Ohio State University, fluent in English, and his views, having spent so much time in the United States, he even owned a home in Washington, were very moderate. You know, he saw the problems with a authoritarian government such as Saudi Arabia and a monarchy under the rule of one man and one man alone. And he was advocating for change. As Mohammed bin Salman went into power, he was being silenced in Saudi Arabia. His friends were being arrested, rounded up, several beheadings. I mean, just horrendous human rights violations. And Jamal decided to put himself into self-exile in Washington, where over the last year of his life, he became a opinions writer for the Washington Post. And October 2nd, 2018, he entered into the Saudi consulate in Istanbul seeking marriage documents to marry his fiancée, Hatice Cengiz. And 2 weeks later, as the world discovered, he was in fact brutally murdered inside that consulate. Is kind of the untold story behind his murder, the why, the how, and many, many variables of what happened that is not really widely known.
As in your storytelling in Icarus, we feel as viewers like we're on the inside of this very compelling story, including your access to the investigators, the Turkish investigators, because this murder happened on technically, I guess, Saudi Arabian consulate soil, but in Turkey.
they were the ones to investigate the murder. Eventually, they got into the consulate. And I want to share that clip that I mentioned a moment ago. We're going to see some of their actual footage as they discover what appears to be a blood trail using luminol to illuminate the blood in a darkened room using a black light. You're going to hear the voice of the Turkish investigator.
Toplantı odasını tesadüfen seçmediler. O odanın özellikle seçilmiş olması kendi ülkeleriyle bir bağlantı içerisinde oldukları senaryosunu doğurmamızı sağladı. Öncesinde, belki sırasında, olay anında ve sonrasında.
And the point that I believe that gentleman was making, Brian, was that this wasn't just some rogue group of people who decided to kill Mr. Khashoggi in the consulate.
Absolutely not. This was a 15-man hit team, assassination team, sent by the Crown Prince using state resources, using private jets, using diplomatic passports on a mission to go and murder Jamal, dismember his body, and dispose of his remains. This was a very, very high-level operation that could have only been ordered by the Crown Prince himself.
The Saudis say, look, the people who were responsible, 8 of the 15 people on that team were ultimately sentenced to some sort of criminal prosecution. We don't know much about it because it's done behind closed doors. They say the people responsible have been held for justice. Do you agree with that?
I do not agree with that. Not only do we not have any details of the mock trial that they held in Saudi Arabia, they locked out any sort of members of the international press from attending the trial. The main perpetrators were not put on trial. So what they did do was apparently they put on trial the henchmen, where the planners, of course, MBS, al-Asiri, his general, Mutreb, who the surgeon, who the forensic coroner, who chopped his body into pieces. And others were not. I'm sorry, that was al-Tubagi. Mutreb was overseeing the operation as the Crown Prince's security detail. These guys, to our knowledge, were not put on trial. There's been no details whatsoever as to this trial period. I mean, this was a complete subversion of any sort of justice or accountability. Turkey has fought for 2 years now to extradite and bring back Jamal's murderers to Turkey where they could stand trial to no avail. So there has been a complete subversion of justice in this murder.
When you watch this film, you think, how could they possibly think this was A, okay, and B, that they could get away with it? Why do you think that is?
Well, first of all, I don't believe for a moment that they thought that they were going to get caught. The idea that Turkey, or who knows, maybe another country, had a listening device in the consulate, in that media room, that they were able to record all the events and then piece together through all their surveillance camera footage throughout Istanbul and airport surveillance, exactly what happened, I don't believe that the Saudis at the time could have fathomed. But the fact that they committed this murder in such an outrageous fashion was just so cavalier. You know, when you look at kind of the whys, you know, they not only did this on Turkish soil, they then sought to frame Turkey for the murder, which I think is why the Turks were so adamant and have done everything that they can to try to hold Saudi Arabia to accountability and to the flame for this murder.
Mohammed bin Salman has been presented to the West, and Saudi Arabia has been very effective in presenting him as a moderate who is trying to bring reform to Saudi Arabia, who is trying to bring the West into Saudi Arabia. As the person who has reported this compelling film, what did you find about that?
Well, look, I think just as Jamal said, which, you know, when you see the dissident, you'll learn a lot more about this. But there's a lot of good that Mohammed bin Salman has been doing for the country. But it's also come at a tremendous price for human rights violations and free speech and freedom of press. His point of view is basically, my opinion is the only opinion that matters. And if you disagree with me, I'm going to lock you up in a jail. I'm going to torture you, or maybe I'm going to murder you. So yes, there has been some really good reforms that have come under Mohammed bin Salman. But at the same time, those inside the kingdom and those who were and are journalists in the kingdom are reporting that it is more repressive than it's ever been. Mm. You look at the case of Lujan al-Hatoul, the Saudi woman human rights activist. She was just sentenced to another 6 years in prison on top of the three that she's already served, so 9 years in total. She's 31 years old now. She was imprisoned at 28. Again, she was educated in the West, fluent in English, and she was advocating that women in the country be allowed to leave their homes without the permission of an 18-year-old male guardian. Mm. She is advocating that women should be able to drive in Saudi Arabia. She was advocating that women should be free to dress as they want. And for this, she remains in a prison. She has been tortured. Even right now with, you know, everything that happened under the Khashoggi murder, Saudi Arabia is not back down. And there are countless Lujain al-Hatouls sitting in Saudi prisons for offering a dissenting opinion that didn't align with Mohammed bin Salman's.
All right, Brian, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, I want to ask Brian about gaining the trust of people who are in danger to tell their stories, both in The Dissident and in his Oscar-winning film, Icarus. We're going to talk about that when we come back.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Program.
I did. This is my morning pill popping routine. And then I prepare the testosterone.
That's a scene from Brian Fogel's Academy Award winning documentary feature film Icarus from 2018. We are back with Brian Fogel, whose new film is The Dissident. Brian, your filmmaking style in The Dissident is different from the one we saw in Icarus. That film was about you as much as it was about Dr. Grigory Rodchenkov, who built the Russian Olympic doping system and revealed it to you. But as in Icarus, you were in danger, in a sense, while making The Dissident. Do you take that into consideration at all as you're making a film like this?
You know, I do. I mean, obviously, these are very, very serious films that tackle difficult subject matter. And when you're taking on Putin or taking on Saudi Arabia and MBS, I guess there's certain risk variables. On the other hand, I think that speaking truth to power, giving voice to the voiceless, helping those that are suffering under oppressive regimes, or in this case, Hatice Cengiz, who lost her fiancé to this horrific crime, Omar Abdulaziz, whose brothers and friends remain in a Saudi prison, as well as countless others, I think has to take precedent over an individual. And so I think I approach filmmaking and the subject matter that I take on from an activist point of view, and thinking about how can my abilities as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, hopefully actually create change. And what I saw with Icarus is when Icarus came out in August of 2017 on Netflix, Russia was still going to the Olympic Games. 5 months later, in the IOC, the Olympic Committee's reasoned decision, they cited Icarus as one of the major reasons for why they banned Russia from the 2018 Pyeongchang Winter Games. And as Trump was leaving office, he actually signed into legislation the Rodchenkov Anti-Doping Act, named after Grigory Rodchenkov, a Russian whistleblower, to criminalize doping in sport, both in the United States and internationally. So here was a case where, you know, this film truly had a huge impact on lawmaking, on global sports, on the Olympics, on top of the accolades that it received for being a solid piece of filmmaking. And so, in making The Dissident, I wanted to take on a story that I felt could really have change and bring some good for the world.
Well, to that end, we know that President Biden has taken a very different attitude towards Saudi Arabia compared to President Trump. He has said, at least while he was campaigning, that he was not going to allow weapons sales to Saudi Arabia. Some Democratic lawmakers have asked him to take a look at the entire policy with regard to our relations with Saudi Arabia. What do you want lawmakers and the general public to know about what you found in your reporting of The Dissident about that relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia?
You know, it's a very complicated relationship. The United States, one of our biggest industries is making weapons and selling them to foreign countries. And to that extent, Saudi Arabia, to my understanding, is the single biggest purchaser of weapons from the United States. The relationship between the U.S. and Saudi goes back decades. Oil and weapons. And of course, there is huge liquidity in Saudi investment vehicles and funds to pour into American companies and tech companies and all sorts of banking. It's very deep. So it's a complicated relationship. And I think that it's one that is, gotten the U.S. In trouble in the sense that we're willing to accept these human rights abuses. We're willing to except that women have, no freedom in that part of the world, in exchange for our business interests. Biden, in his first days in office, literally 2 or 3 days ago, literally blocked $500 million weapon sales to Saudi and the Emirates. He cited seeking justice for Jamal in doing that and also to try to stop the war in Yemen. The Biden administration has made it very clear that they seek to reassess the U.S.-Saudi relationship and our dependence or interdependence on each other in light of their human rights violations. So I think it'll be very interesting to see, how this relationship transpires during the Biden administration.
And Brian, that's the view from 30,000 feet. Your film also takes us right down to ground level, and it is into the most intimate moments of, for example, Jamal Khashoggi's widow, Hatrice, and we see her grieving and mourning, and you have to gain her trust as a filmmaker and as a journalist filmmaker. And I would imagine that's such an immense responsibility that you carry on your shoulders. Can you speak to me about that?
You know, in the process of making this project, you know, I think of Hatice Cengiz as Jamal's fiance, as my sister at this point. I think of Omar Abdulaziz, Saudi in self-exile, as my brother. You know, you cannot help but get very personally and deeply involved in the lives of these people that have been so deeply impacted and affected by Jamal's murder. And in the case of Omar, you know, somebody who wakes up every day fighting for freedom of speech in his country that he lives in self-exile from, while his friends and family are imprisoned for knowing him. And so much of this work is building trust. Mm-hmm. And in the case of both Atija and Omar, I spent months building trust with them before we began actually filming. And my promise to both of them was that I was going to be on this journey with them, that I wasn't there to shoot an interview or to spend a day or a week, but that I was there to go on this journey with them and be there as long as it took, not only to make the film, but to this day. And I think that is what allows for trust building between a filmmaker and the subject. And in my case, I think I view myself as an activist first, and a humanitarian. And then I look at the craft of cinema and filmmaking.
I see.
And I think that the trust that I was able to gain with Atija and Omar really spoke to a personal relationship rather than a relationship between, you know, a filmmaker and his or her subject.
And Omar, who you mentioned, really gave us an open look into the social media warfare that's going on as well. And I'll ask you about that during our audio podcast. Right now, we're going to take a short break. Why is this film not on Netflix or Amazon Prime as a free offering? Why do you have to pay for it? We'll ask Brian in just a moment.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We're back with Brian Fogel talking about The Dissident. Brian, why isn't this film available for free on Netflix or Amazon Prime?
Look, I can't speak as to why they did not acquire the film. I'm disappointed, but it is available on VOD across all platforms where people can go and rent it and see it, and I hope that they will. It was crafted as a big cinematic thriller that just so happens to be a documentary, and if you loved Icarus, I think you'll love The Dissident, and hopefully people will find it on their VOD platforms.
Brian, one thing that Omar does for us in this film is that he takes us into this social media warfare that's underway. And can you speak to that and tell us what is happening on platforms, specifically on Twitter?
Well, what Omar discovered is that Saudi Arabia, likely other countries too, were able to exploit algorithms and back channels into Twitter, essentially to push forward their own propaganda, change hashtags, delete other people's tweets, or in the case of what was happening with Omar and Jamal, as you see in The Dissident, any single time that Omar or Jamal would send out a tweet. Their tweets were literally attacked by thousands of government trolls and employees of the Saudi government that would push their tweets down by suppressing them and calling them traitors and calling them all sorts of names, while at the same time making hashtags like, you know, MBS is great and, you know, Vision 2030 and all of his hashtags trend. We get into real detail into this in The Dissident, and it's fascinating, and it's also still going on.
Jamal's widow, Hatice, Jeff Bezos, who was Jamal's ultimate employer as the owner of The Washington Post, he was at the ceremony that everyone attended upon the anniversary of his death, and he looked at her and essentially said, you know, you are not alone. We are here with you. Has he been there for her?
I think you would need to ask Hatice that question, but, you know, in my opinion, he has not been.
Why do you say that?
Well, you know, the film is available for rental rather than as an Amazon original. And, you know, I don't believe that there's been any meaningful action taken. But, you know, I think that question would be best suited for Hatice. But I do feel that Jeff Bezos could and should do more to help in the aftermath of Jamal's murder.
Hatice was about to begin the rest of her life with the love of her life, Jamal Khashoggi, and then it was taken away from her. She is still a relatively young woman. Jamal was 60, but she's younger. What will happen to her now? What is the rest of her life going to look like?
You know, she is an incredibly strong woman, strong-minded. She's now fluent in English, she is continuing in her quest to seek justice for Jamal. Had we not been in the pandemic, she'd be living in Washington, working on getting her foundation going, seeking human rights accountability in Saudi Arabia and other parts of the world, you know, petitioning lawmakers for change. And businesses. And if you, you know, do a search on her and read, you know, press over the last several months and articles written about her, she's really carrying on this work and carrying on Jamal's voice. And she's an extraordinary woman.
Finally, I wonder, before all of this, before Icarus and now The Dissident, you were a playwright, a producer, an actor, a writer, and I wonder if this has all this plunge into documentary filmmaking, where you're taking on these meaty, important subjects and people, has it caused you on a personal level to reexamine your life and to think about how that you want to spend your time and what you want to do with your life?
Well, I think, you know, the answer to that is yes. And I've basically been doing just that. You know, following the success of Icarus, having the tremendous honor of winning an Academy Award, I think I could have picked any project to go and do, whether that was a scripted feature or television or another documentary. And I chose to make The Dissident because it was a story that resonated with me, because it spoke truth to power. Talked about, it's about freedom of press, freedom of journalists, it's about freedom of journalism, human rights. You know, it's a love story within a tragedy, and there's some real global change and impact can come from it. And if I'm going to spend my time and my life, you know, crafting film, then I'm hoping that I can continue to make films that can not only enlighten and educate, but have a real impact.
Brian, thank you for your work and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Frank. Pleasure talking to you, and appreciate you taking the time to give this film a little bit more of a voice. It means a lot.
My thanks again to Brian Fogel. If you'd like to see The Dissident, it is available on demand. And if you'd like to see our conversation, you can find it right now on demand on YouTube. Of course, it's free. Just search on YouTube with the search terms Frank Buckley and Jamal Khashoggi. As always, I appreciate the feedback on social media at Frank Buckley TV on Twitter and on Instagram. And thanks for telling your friends about our podcast and TV program. We drop a new podcast every Wednesday, and we air our TV shows on KTLA every weekend. Thanks for joining us this week, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.